This is KFSK's Midday Magazine for Friday, September 23rd. I'm Angela Denning. Governor Bill Walker announced this morning exactly how much Alaskans would receive in this year's permanent fund dividend check.
There you go, $1,022. So I'm glad that given our loss of 80% of our revenue, we are able to have a dividend over $1,000, and I will look forward to working with the legislature to ensure that will continue on for generations to come.
Again, the amount is $1,022. Governor Walker made the announcement by a pre-recorded video released this morning. This year's dividend checks could have been about twice as much, but Walker vetoed half the money appropriated to dividends earlier this year while the state battles a $4 billion deficit. PFD checks will be distributed starting October 6th. Gale force winds and high seas on the outer coast are keeping about 4,500 cruise ship travelers from seeing Sitka this week. Three Holland American Line ships, the Westerdam, Amsterdam, and the Maasdam, have canceled their port calls. Sherry Aitken is director of tourism for Visit Sitka, which is part of the Greater Sitka Chamber of Commerce.
Largely, it's because they have to go on the outside of Baranof Island. They cannot take the path of the ferries through the inner island areas there, and so they're exposed to any type of heavy seas, and right now it's tremendously heavy seas.
The ships were scheduled for Wednesday, Thursday, and today. Two ships are still scheduled to call in Sitka before the end of this month. The Norwegian Jewel is slated to stop by on Saturday, and the Westerdam next Wednesday. Aitken hopes the weather will allow them to sail.
September is a time when you've probably made your cost for the season, and you're looking at expanding your margin of profitability.
Weather cancellations aren't all that unusual for this time of year in Sitka. Storms kept the 380-passenger Silver Shadow from calling on September 10th. 3 years ago, two of the larger ships also skipped Sitka at the end of the season.
I think it's always disappointing that we don't have the potential guests here, and it's great when we can finish up in September strong. But for us, for Sitka, it is really weather dependent.
Alaska is seeing just over 1 million cruise ship passengers this season, but only 12% of them, or 120,000, visit Sitka. Tourism officials expect that number to climb next year when Holland America and Celebrity have planned additional calls in Sitka. There will be no commercial season for red and blue king crab in Southeast again this year. There has been a slight increase in some crab numbers, but not enough to warrant opening the fishery. The fall red and blue king crab fishery has been opened only twice in the past decade, in 2005 and 2011. The numbers are still at historically low levels.
The stock health in the surveyed areas ranged from below average to poor.
Joe Stratman is Alaska Department of Fish and Game's lead crab biologist for Southeast. He and other biologists track two groups of king crab in Southeast: the legal biomass and mature biomass. Basically, the legal crabs are crabs that are big enough to be harvested in the commercial fishery. The mature biomass also includes crabs that are sexually mature, but not big enough to be landed.
Both mature and legal survey biomasses declined on the average of 7% annually from 2001 to 2013.
Since then, however, there have been some small increases.
I can show you this too, sort of.
He gets out a piece of paper. That's a graph.
Some background. This is what I mean here, where, you know, 2013 was kind of the sort of the low point, I guess, for legal and mature biomass. Things have been ticking down, like I said, since 2001. But we have seen some increases in 2014.
The growth has been modest region-wide, but it's an increase nonetheless.
You know, we are generally seeing things trending up since 2013 as far as the biomass estimates go.
The state can open Southeast commercial season if the estimated amount of legal size male king crab tops a minimum threshold of 200,000 pounds, but that wasn't close to happening this year. Fish and Game monitors the king crab population through annual catch surveys in seven areas called CSAs. They also work with local fishermen on a mark and recapture project.
We can charter industry vessels, and they can use the gear that they want to use. They can use the bait they want to use, and within the bays, fish the areas they want to fish, and to basically come up with another biomass estimate that we can kind of hold up against our CSA estimate.
The mark and recapture project also shows low numbers of king crab. The southeast commercial fishery for king crab has been below the threshold for most of the last decade. The fishery is lucrative if it does happen. In the last opening 5 years ago, fishermen got $10 a pound. Red king crabs are the largest shellfish in the state. They can live up to 20 to 30 years and can have a leg span of 5 feet. Blue king crabs are incidental catches for fishermen, representing only about 1% of the king crab population in Southeast. While commercial fishing is closed, the personal use fishery has been open in limited areas, allowing for one crab a day. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning. Alaska's Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott was the keynote speaker at this week's annual meeting of Southeast Conference in Petersburg. During a speech Wednesday, Mallott addressed climate change and fisheries, this year's failed pink salmon runs, mining concerns on the transboundary rivers in Southeast Alaska, the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, and the Alaska Marine Highway System. Joe Vicknicki spoke with Mallott Tuesday about some of those topics, along with logging of Alaska Mental Health Trust land near Petersburg. First, the Lieutenant Governor spoke on the latest on an agreement between Alaska and British Columbia over mining projects near the transboundary rivers.
We have been working for over a year on what has come to be known as a statement of cooperation, which essentially is nothing more than a framework that gives us the ability to engage with the British Columbia government in allowing the state of Alaska to have a seat at their table as they permit mines in British Columbia, and to allow us to comment, to allow us to engage with them on an ongoing basis, allow us to review and see their entire permitting process, allows us to raise issues as we see them. The SOC will also, from our perspective, that is State of Alaska perspective, allow us to use the processes that we establish in a very transparent way to communicate with all of Alaska's stakeholders on what we are doing. I mentioned specifically Alaska because British Columbia, their relationship with public the way they do public communication is different from the way we do it, we're going to have to see how that goes. I think they sincerely have a commitment to engage with their own public, their own stakeholders, of course, but our insistence in Alaska on transparency, on openness, on engagement with stakeholders is something also that is a way to utilize the SOC, but it's just one tool in a much larger toolkit.
I wanted to ask kind of a local issue, but I know it's one also important in Ketchikan. You were also just down there as mm-hmm. well, and it's about Alaska Mental Health Trust logging. Mm-hmm. I know Mental Health Trust is a separate corporation of the state, but it was mm-hmm. also created by the state of Alaska to fund mental health services. There's a lot of concern here with the potential of logging the hillside south of town from mm-hmm. here, as well as the hillside on Deer Mountain in Ketchikan. Is there anything that state government of Alaska can do in mitigating that kind of conflict between homeowners and people who live below these forested slopes and the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority?
Well, they are an independent authority established as the result of settlement of litigation. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority has the legal task to transform these assets into revenue to meet their important program needs, but that doesn't mean that in any way that they should or would otherwise not engage fully with the people that are impacted by their decisions, that they not be fully utilizing public processes of communication and engagement, of giving the public the full opportunity to review, to comment on their projects. I think, at least in Ketchikan, that they are engaged at the local level with both pursuing a federal legislative fix, which would involve a land trade of some kind. There have been discussions at the local level, as I understand it, of the local government or governments being involved with either a purchase or some other kind of transaction which would keep Deer Mountain from being logged. I think that there are options, and this is coming from someone who's been involved over the years in a lot of very tough, intense negotiations over land use in the Tongass National Forest, that there is a way through this that would meet the needs of the Mental Health Trust, but also preserve the integrity and the beauty of these landscapes that people care so much about. I'm not as fully aware of the Petersburg circumstance. I understand that possibly even Wrangell may have an issue. But wherever these occur, where there is a difference of view, where local folks are opposed to a particular project, either a project by government or, for example, in the instance of the transboundary issue, by private corporations, or even in our own state, by private corporations, we need to seek resolution that, if not creating a win-win circumstance for all involved, at least having a process in which the decision is respected because everyone understands all aspects of it. In the instance of Ketchikan and hopefully Petersburg, where the consequence is something that can affect the future of a community, and I don't think I say that lightly, because our places, the places in which we live, are settings of world-class beauty. Every one of our communities is a very special place, and for us to take actions that would, I don't think that this is too big a word, that would desecrate that reality. I think those are big deals, and I think we can work through them.
Are we missing anything important, any other topic I haven't asked about that you'd like to highlight?
Well, certainly Governor Walker recently pulled back the implementation of essentially a merger of some functions of the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission with the Department of Fish and Game because of a lawsuit filed by a Petersburg fisherman and because of conversations with Petersburg-led fishermen. The governor has put that effort into abeyance and looking forward to working with fisheries groups in order to resolve it again in a way that can be, relative to their earlier discussion, a win-win. Also, across the state, there's been a very broad-based failure of the pink salmon run, which is key to the success of the industry in our state. It's a high volume fish, and the state is already implementing disaster actions where that is appropriate. Requests are coming in from other parts of the state, so this is a very important issue for our fishing communities across the state.
Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott says the target is the end of this month or early next month for signing that statement of cooperation on mining with British Columbia. You can hear Mallott's entire keynote address to the Southeast Conference on our website, kfsk.org. This year's Haynes subsistence moose hunt was the fastest harvest in recent memory. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game issued an emergency order on Wednesday, declaring that the season would close Thursday at midnight. That means the hunt that usually extends about 3 weeks is wrapping up after only 8 days. KHNS's Emily Files reports from Haynes.
Fish and game biologist Carl Koch was not expecting this.
It is pretty
pretty amazing, pretty surprising how fast this year went.
Koch took over management of the Unit 1D moose hunt last year, and that was an unusual hunt itself. The harvest went quickly, and Koch closed the season after about 2 weeks. It was the first time the Haynes moose hunt had closed early in about 20 years. Then this season happened.
It's basically twice as fast as last year, over in a week. A lot of moose taken very quickly.
Hunters have 3 days to turn their moose in, so this season's numbers aren't final. But as of Wednesday afternoon, 25 moose had been taken. The management goal for the hunt is between 20 and 25 bulls, so Koch decided Wednesday to close the season early. He's not sure why the hunt went so quickly. It could be the weather or that hunters are getting out earlier.
It's certainly possible that there's more moose out there, but we've had poor survey conditions for the past several years. And with the last survey having 18 bulls per 100 cows, we have to be conservative.
The ideal bull-to-cow ratio is 25 to 100. Fish and Game conducts an aerial moose survey of the Chilkat Valley each winter. The past couple years' weather conditions meant biologists weren't able to conduct the flying surveys until many bulls had shed their antlers, which led to less reliable information.
We're really hoping for better weather conditions so we can get a really good survey in, preferably in November, before they start dropping antlers.
Koch says for now they've got to work with the somewhat limited information they have. He says the rapid harvest this year and last doesn't mean Fish and Game will change the length of the season or management goals.
I don't want to go rushing to any hasty decisions. We always have this option of an emergency order, which we've exercised in the last 2 years. And we could get years with mild weather where we go back to the more typical year. Some seasons we've had less than 20 bulls in the entire 3-week season.
Fish and Game allows for 250 moose hunting permits in Unit 1D. Legal moose are determined based on their antler configuration. The 25 taken as of Wednesday afternoon include 5 spike fork, 15 three-brow tine, 2 50-plus inch, and 2 sublegal. Wildlife troopers also found evidence of a moose that was killed but not checked into Fish and Game, which is illegal. Koch says there's a chance the number of moose harvested will exceed Fish and Game's management goal, but overall, he's happy with how the season went. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
It is Friday, September the 23rd, and that means it's time for our Stocks Report with Dan Berg. He's a financial advisor with Wells Fargo Advisors in Bellevue, Washington, and he's joining us now by telephone. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
So what can you share with us this week?
Well, there was a long-anticipated Federal Reserve meeting where they decide on short-term rates, the overnight rates that they charge the banks and banks charge each other. And the no news was good news, and so we had a very nice midweek rally on that. We gave away some of the gains today, but on the whole, it was a sort of a relief week. I guess that's how you would characterize it. And so there's no change in short-term rates for now. However, the case for a rate hike has strengthened, they say. But interestingly, there were 3 of the boards of governors of the Fed that dissented. That's a very rare thing, and that shows that there's some real disagreement, and probably it strengthens the case for a rate hike come December, but that's after the election. And the other change was that they have a plot of where they believe interest rates, short-term interest rates, should go in the future, and it's very clear that they're going to be lower for longer. That's the word from the Fed, lower for longer. And over in Asia, the Bank of Japan has been fighting deflation for years, and they have been in a situation in and out of recession with very little economic growth. They have changed their strategy somewhat, and the bank itself is going to try to have influence on long-term rates as well as short-term rates. So the Bank of Japan is getting creative over there, trying to put some oomph into the Japanese economy. So for the week, the Dow Jones closed at 18,261. That's a 138-point gain for the week. The NASDAQ did reasonably well. They closed at 5305. That's a 1.1% gain for the week. And the S&P closed at 2164, also 1.1% gain. Oil, which has been coming down a bit lately, closed at 44.27. That's a little bit more than a dollar greater than last week. There again is talk. OPEC is trying mightily to find some form of agreement to cap output. So far, no agreement, but they're still talking. Gold jumped nicely on the Federal Reserve announcement. They closed at $1,337 an ounce. That was up from $1,305 last week. Now, regarding the bond market, the Treasury yields drifted a little bit lower, along with a more dovish outlook from the Federal Reserve. The 30-year is at 2.34%, and a 10-year Treasury yield gives us a whopping 1.61% yield.
All right. Well, thanks for sharing that information. Any individual stocks that you're keeping your eyes on and want to share with us?
Yeah, we had some interesting news. FedEx, which is the number two package delivery company, they, along with UPS, are kind of a canary in the coal mine for economic activity. Symbol FDX announced earnings, and they really had a good report, and that stock was up nicely to 174.39. Adobe Software, ADBE, closed up nicely also on their earnings at $106.56 a share. General Foods also announced earnings, an okay report. GIS closed at 64.65. And then today there was a little bit of fireworks in the shares of Twitter, symbol TWTR. That closed up about 10% to $22.62. There is talk of a buyout. It's not clear that that will actually happen, but there was sure some speculative money going into that stock today. And then regarding Northwest issues, Microsoft was in the news in a very nice way. Symbol MSFT closed at $57.42. They announced an 8% increase in their already nice dividend, and they announced a $40 billion, that's with a B, buyback of stock over the next couple of years. Now, keep in mind, if things change, circumstances change for Microsoft, they can cancel that buyback. But that does support the stock price, certainly, as they buy back shares. And then finally, Alaska Airlines, symbol ALK, closed at $65.77.
Okay, thanks. And what's coming up this coming week, next week?
Well, we have a fairly active week as far as economic reports. We're going to get a look at second quarter gross domestic product, and that might even be part of the political discussion at some point. But we also have personal income and spending. That's looked at very closely because of the central role the American consumer is playing here. And we also have durable goods orders and new home sales. We'll also keep an eye on Germany. They're the most important economy in Europe, the biggest one. They have a business confidence index and their unemployment rate. And so far, Germany has been plugging along, and so people are keeping a nervous eye on things in Europe. And then for announcements for earnings next week or other corporate announcements, we have two Northwest companies, Costco, Nike, and then outside of the Northwest, there is Carnival Cruise Lines and PepsiCo. So there'll be a lot of eyes looking at Nike and Costco for sure.
All right. Well, we'll check in with you next week to hear all about that.
Great. Thank you, Angela.
Thanks so much for joining us this week.
You're welcome.
Dan Berg is a financial advisor with Wells Fargo Advisors in Bellevue, Washington.
Listeners are reminded that the information provided is general in nature and may not apply to their personal investment situation. Individuals should consult with their chosen financial professional before making any decisions. Investment products and services are offered through Wells Fargo Advisors, LLC, member of SIPC. Neither Wells Fargo Advisors nor its financial professionals are legal or tax advisors.
This wraps up KFSK's Midday Magazine. I'm Angela Denning. Thanks for listening.